Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick. Flora, you have the next installment in our Desktop Diary series, in which you get to know scientists by asking them about their desk trinkets.
That's right.
And who do we have today?
It's Daniel Kahneman today. He is a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist and the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, which you may have seen on many of the best book lists of the year, The Economist's list and the New York Times Book Reviews list. And Dr. Kahneman let us stop by his New York City apartment for the Desktop Diary, but here's the thing, Ira.
No, no desk. I haven't used a desk for many years.
And that's not all.
I have always emphasized the willingness to discard.
So,
what a challenge.
That's a challenge.
Desktop Diary, no desk.
No desk, no trinkets.
No trinkets, no desk.
Very clean, this workspace.
Does he at least have a medal to go with the Nobel Prize? Did I give him a medal?
Well, it's funny. You should ask that. That was the first thing I wanted to see. We had to sort of ask some questions, get to know each other. But all I wanted to see was what the Nobel Prize looks like. So eventually we started talking about it. And I asked, do you get a physical thing? I'm thinking like the Olympics.
Like, sure, maybe like they put around something your neck. Your neck. You sure, right?
Yeah. And he said, oh, yeah, they do. And I can go get it for you. And let me show it to you. So Dr. Kahneman walks over to the other room, and the door is slightly ajar, and I don't really want to, you know, invade his personal space.
Right.
This is his
right.
home. But it becomes clear, little by little, that we're not finding it. There's some rummaging around.
I lost the medal.
It was amazing.
Honey, have you seen the medal?
It was amazing.
Yeah,
it was amazing. He didn't initially find it, but his wife knew where it was, and so.
This is Science Friday from NPR with a great story from Flora Lichtman about looking for a Nobel Prize medal. And you say he did eventually find it.
It was so charming, though. Mm-hmm. You know, that he was like, you know, I haven't taken it out in that long, which makes sense, although I feel like I'd be sleeping with it, like, under my pillow or something, making myself feel better every day by looking at it. But anyway, we eventually saw it, and it's much bigger than an Olympic medal, it seemed to me. It was quite large. And they also give you this other nice stuff. So he had a sort of dossier of pictures and
give you chocolate coins too.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Those maybe were gone by now. It was 2002 when Dr. Kahneman got this award. But just to give you a sense of what Dr. Kahneman has done.
Right.
So he's a psychologist, and he's done a lot of observational research over the course of his career on how people make decisions. But he got the Nobel Prize for Economic Sciences, and the reason is because before his work, one of the sort of basic tenets of economics, and, you know, economists will know this story better than I do, but the basic premise is that people operated in their self-interest, and that people can be rational decision makers, you know, except maybe when passion or love or fear is involved. And what Dr. Kahneman and his colleague Amos Tversky showed was that people make irrational decisions all the time.
Really?
That they're I know. Well, look, it hadn't been shown before.
They got the prize for that.
They showed it through observation. So I wanted to give you an example of one of the demonstrations that they did. This is Dr. Kahneman's favorite, he said.
My personal favorite is what I've called non-regressive prediction. That is that people make absurdly extreme predictions on the basis of very weak evidence. So if I tell you about this graduating senior, and I call her Julie, that she read fluently at age 4, and I ask you what's her GPA, you have an answer. An answer comes to mind. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. And furthermore, it's a very narrow range of answers. And it's an absurd answer that comes to everybody's mind. So I think that's my favorite. I find it mostly, a lot of it, I find amusing and sort of interesting. I'm really an observer, but I don't ask myself a lot, what does it mean about mankind or humankind or whatever? I don't.
So you get the sense that, you know, you shouldn't have an answer to something like that. The fact that Julie could read at age 4 shouldn't suggest to you a GPA 20 years down or 15 years down the line.
Yeah. And it's our video pick of the week. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's Desktop Diaries, a challenge to Flora this week, having no desktop and no diary.
But a wonderful interview.
And it's great. Yes, it's a great interview. A little slice of life. And he lived in the Upper West Side.
No, it was Village.
The Village.
Yeah, it was a beautiful apartment. Just for that, it might be worth looking. And check out all of our other desktop diaries. We've done so many over the years. You know, Temple Grandin, Oliver Sacks, many
desktop diaries. E.O. Wilson. And they're there. And if you think you know what's on Brian Greene's desktop, for example, another spare one, right?
Exactly. I remembered the Brian Greene shoot vividly when I got there, and I was like, "There's nothing here. We're in this situation again." But for the other ones, we have lots of trinkets,
lots
and they
of
really
stuff.
End up being a kind of yeah. nice. They're windows to people's soul.
And we have a couple in the works, right?
Oops. We do. Jill Tarter, we met with, who you heard on the program last week, and Tim White. So look forward to the more coming up.
And they make up in trinkets what we didn't have on the desktop this time. All right.
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you, Flora. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora Lichtman is our correspondent and managing editor for video. Our associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Sam Flato was our production assistant. Eli Chen, our assistant producer. Neil Rauch, our technical director, spinning the controls here in New York. Missed any part of our program? You can go over to our website, subscribe to our podcasts, and also, you know, you can listen to them later on any of your portable devices that you have, especially our app that you can download for your portable device. Also, we're talking all week long on Facebook, and also you can find us and Twitter us at SciFry. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
For a long time, the image of poverty in the United States was a struggling inner city, or perhaps a downtrodden rural town. So this might be a surprise. Poverty has increased everywhere in America in recent years, but mostly in the suburbs. During the last decade, it grew twice as fast there as it did in the cities. And now more poor people live in the suburbs than in urban and rural areas. To learn more about what this means, NPR's Pam Fessler took a tour of a suburban county outside Washington, D.C. with Elizabeth Kneebone of the Brookings Institution, who's written a new book on the subject. Here's Pam's report.
We're driving right now through an area that looks incredibly well off. We begin our tour of Montgomery County, Maryland, in a place called Bethesda. Streets are lined with luxury apartments, big homes, crowded restaurants. But Elizabeth Kneebone of Brookings says that's deceiving.
Montgomery County is one of the wealthiest counties in the country, but it also has a rapidly growing poor population.
She says since the recession, poverty here has grown by two-thirds. That means 30,000 more residents living below the federal poverty line, about $23,000 for a family of four, which doesn't get you very much around here. Kneebone says suburban poverty has grown all across the U.S. More than 16 million poor people now live in the nation's suburbs, in low-income and working-class neighborhoods.
But it's also occurring in places we think of as more affluent. And in fact, it may even be more hidden there because we don't expect to find poverty in those communities.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our first stop is a place in this county where poverty is no surprise. Nana Food Center in Gaithersburg, not far from Bethesda. About two dozen people are lined up for food.
Grab one item from here and then get whatever bread you can use.
Standing with the help of a cane, 64-year-old Polly Maxwell checks out the box she's been given today.
Oh, that's great. I got, this is ice milk, that's good. The cookies I can give to my grandson, and the fruit I love. That's the only thing I can see right now. And chicken, oh my God, yeah. Chicken
Maxwell says she started coming here a couple of years ago. After working 38 years at a local hospital, mostly in medical records, she now lives on disability checks. And she says things have gotten way too expensive. She spends half her income on an $800 a month rent.
What you were making in 2 weeks when I was working, that's what I would make a month. I mean, it's hard. And I just never thought it would be like that. So it's really, you have to get used to not, you know, some your money lasts a month, sometimes it doesn't.
And she's hardly alone. This center, like food pantries across the country, has seen its caseload double since the recession. fact, in the car, Elizabeth Kneebone says Montgomery County is fairly typical. Suburban poverty has grown nationally because low-income families moved from cities or other countries in search of better schools, affordable housing, and jobs. But she says it's also about people like Polly Maxwell, longtime suburbanites who have gotten poorer.
And the Great Recession was particularly severe. Widespread job losses, many of them concentrated in suburban communities hit hard by the collapse of the housing market and the loss of construction jobs and related services.
And even though jobs are coming back to the suburbs, many pay too little to make ends meet. Kneebone says even social services and charities have been slow to recognize the shift. Most of their resources still go to the nation's cities, where there's a long history of serving the poor. Which brings us to our next stop.
Yeah, you're in, so just have a seat, and then one of the nurses will be right with you.
All righty, thank you.
About a dozen women, most with young children, sit in a waiting room at Mary's Center, located in Silver Spring, an area where many immigrants live. Mary's Center has provided medical and other help to the poor for 25 years. But until recently, all of its facilities were in Washington, D.C., until this suburban site opened in 2008. Zuma Aparicio is site director.
We were figuring out that when we were over there at the other sites that we have in D.C., it was a lot of population from Maryland who were traveling from here to there, and they were, you know, paying fares for the bus, metro, and all of this. And now, I mean, they continue on paying, but it's closer.
Elizabeth Kneebone says for the suburban poor, that's a big issue. Transportation. Everything's so spread out, it can be hard to get where you need to go, especially if you don't own a car. And that takes us to our third stop. We drive back to Gaithersburg, near the center of the county. It was farmland a few decades ago. Now it's filled with townhouses where many low-income families live. But Kneebone points out that some of the countryside remains.
As soon as you get off the main road, you're now without sidewalks, so how do people walk to a bus stop that might be nearby, let alone a job or a school?
We arrive at what looks like a typical office park, but instead of businesses, it's filled with nonprofits and social service agencies.
My name is Pearline Tyson, and I'm the program manager for the Neighborhood Opportunity Network for Montgomery County.
She manages what amounts to a one-stop shop for struggling families who live nearby. Tyson says the county's trying to address the growth in poverty. It recently opened three of these centers in neighborhoods it knew had been especially hard hit by the recession.
And they knew that some people would be intimidated by going to a regional center to apply for benefits, especially people who had never received benefits before or was not you know, familiar with government services.
Here, everything's accessible. People who come are assigned a county worker to help navigate what can be a labyrinth of benefit programs and charitable services. For Akuavi Davi and her husband, who came here from West Africa, it's been a godsend.
I'm so happy because I know I have somebody who can help me now.
They had been getting by on their own until a back injury forced Davi to give up her job at Walmart. Then their daughter left her 4-year-old son, Joshua, in their care. Now only her husband works as a security guard.
You have electricity problem. You have apartment problem. I have health problem. I don't have insurance.
And to complicate matters, she doesn't drive, which is one reason this family moved last month from a neighborhood further out where there are no bus lines to a place near the center where there are lots of buses. Kneebone says when you're poor, geography matters. Low-income residents can spend long hours trying to get services, time that might be better spent working or going to school. She says at least this county is trying to adjust. Many have yet to do so.
We're still thinking about poverty where it was in 1964 when President Johnson launched the war on poverty. We think about it as a very urban phenomenon or a rural challenge, and the reality on the ground today is just very different.
A reality, she says, that's unlikely to change if people don't know that it's there. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
Summer's almost here, and with it comes the army of interns who will turn up in countless American workplaces. It can be a boon for the inexperienced, but more and more, interns are growing restless that they're being exploited. Increasingly, interns have been willing to push back. Some have even sued. This week, one of those cases suffered a setback when a judge in New York ruled that a group of 3,000 former interns could not pursue a lawsuit against the Hearst Corporation as a class action. They would each have to sue the company as individuals. To understand what this means for interns, we turn to Ross Perlin. He's the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jackie.
Bit of a cynical title.
Well, perhaps, but I think it's also just kind of a reality that the internship has become virtually a requirement for getting into the white-collar workforce, certainly. It's something that the majority of students at four-year colleges do at least once before they graduate. Many do it two, three, four, or more times. An estimated quarter, third of all internships are unpaid. Many more are low-paid as well. So those are the ones we're really focusing on.
So, Ross, take us into some where these extended unpaid internships have become contentious.
The five lawsuits that have been filed encompass the one you've mentioned, Jackie, involving Hearst, and that's a fashion and kind of media internship. You're looking at Elite Model Management is kind of the last of these lawsuits to have been filed, an internship involving sports and kind of sports management stuff. There is the first of these lawsuits involving the Black Swan film with Fox Searchlight Pictures. There's a film that made $300 million, had many unpaid interns working on it, doing very fundamental work like keeping the books, and they were unpaid, and this is a widespread problem in the world of film. The Black Swan case, as I understand, they are going through this process of ensuring that it's going to be certified as a class, all the interns who are involved, and I should say that this decision on the Hearst case also about whether or not all the interns who worked there can be considered a class, it is a setback in the sense that it becomes harder for groups of interns to kind of get together, and it makes it less likely that lawyers will take those cases. Hmm. One of these cases has been settled already. That involved the Charlie Rose program, mm-hmm. and that was settled not long ago for, I believe, $250,000. So that one is not setting any kind of precedent, but at least the interns are going to see some of their wages at last.
But let's take Black Swan or Hearst. You can make the argument that this looks great on the resume. Why should interns expect to have rights in the workplace?
I think there are a lot of reasons why interns should have rights in the way that other workers do. I think it's particularly as internships have become a kind of broken signal, as those opportunities were not there at the end of the hard work, that people realized that this sort of informal bargain was already being sort of broken and that people were having to do more and more internships to get there. And then even at that point, they were going to be left doing precarious forms of labor as freelancers and temps and other things.
So I'm sure by now we've thoroughly bummed out people seeking internships. Any red flags that people should look for?
Well, first I should say that, of course, there are really good internships out there. In terms of red flags, in terms of identifying problematic internships from the start, in general, any for-profit company that's advertising an unpaid internship, you have to look at it very carefully. So it has to be clear that they understand that it's really a training program. If they're asking, you know, for somebody who has deep experience with Photoshop, can design websites, and, you know, has lots of other experience, and then they're saying, oh, sorry, we're actually not going to be able to pay. And by the way, you know, oh, we'll give you some school credit. That also should raise a red flag because school credit is given out by schools. And that really should not come into play unless there is a real relationship that's been built between the employer and a given college.
Ross Perlin is the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Ross, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jackie.
American institutions, from government to Wall Street to small-town Rotary clubs, have broken down. That's what journalist George Packer says in a new book. It's called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he often covers the political scene. His book, The Assassin's Gate, took him to the streets of Baghdad in the middle of the Iraq War. But Packer's new book looks at the last few turbulent decades of life here in America and profiles some of the most famous and successful Americans, as well as people you've probably never heard of, a community organizer, a local entrepreneur, a disenchanted Washington lobbyist. Packer weaves these profiles together to tell a larger story about this moment in America, a moment, he says, in which the country has lost something vital.
I think of it as a deal that used to exist among Americans, a deal that maybe lasted half a century, from the 30s to the late 70s, in which everyone had a place. People were more constrained than they are today. They had less freedom, but they had more security. And there was a sense in which each generation felt that the next generation would be able to improve itself, to do better, and that there were channels of opportunity, education, jobs, that would allow people's children to rise. And I think over the last generation, that deal has come undone. And instead, many Americans feel that they're all alone, that no one is going to help them, and that in a way there's a kind of unfairness at play in our society where elites seem to do better and better, and ordinary people who might have once even thought of themselves as middle class struggle more and more. That's what's unwound in my adult lifetime.
You just outlined a pretty dire situation. Did you start to hone in on this theme, this idea of an unwinding, purely from the financial institution meltdown of 2008, or was there something else that you were seeing that led you to this place?
You know, I think it began with the Iraq War. I covered Iraq for The New Yorker. I wrote a book about it. And I'd begun by seeing that war as a failure of individual leaders. But over time, I saw that whole institutions were failing. The military at the beginning of the war failed. Intelligence, the media failed. And then the financial crisis made it seem as if there was something epical going on. And that's when I began to think, how would I write about a country that is watching its core institutions collapse? I wanted to do it as a narrative. I wanted to pull together stories of Americans whose lives have kind of moved to the pulse of this recent history. And so I went about the country trying to find people whose stories fit in with that larger narrative.
Which you do. You include a wide variety of vignettes and profiles of Americans. Some of them are famous. Newt Gingrich, Oprah Winfrey. But you also write about people who are just Americans. One character in particular, a woman named Tammy Thomas. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Tammy was born, raised, and still lives in Youngstown, Ohio. She's African American. She grew up during a time when Youngstown was a steel town, and it was a union town. But around the time she was a teenager, the steel mills just collapsed one after another in rapid succession. And Youngstown collapsed with them so quickly that it became a kind of icon of deindustrialization. And I spent a lot of time with Tammy driving around the city, looking at the landmarks of her life and hearing her story, which was an incredible story of a woman who, her mother was a heroin addict. She was not close to her father. She had three children without their fathers really being in their lives. But she got a job in an auto parts factory, and that allowed her to raise the kids and to hold herself and them together amid an absolutely disastrous situation in Youngstown. And then, around the time of the financial crisis and the election of Barack Obama, having lost her job because the auto parts factory went bankrupt, she remade herself as a community organizer, and that's what she's doing now. She has not given up on Youngstown, and I think even though these institutions are collapsing and people do feel they're on their own, the individuals in the book, people like Tammy and Dean Price, who maybe we can talk about from North Carolina, there's a resilience and even an optimism that's kind of remarkable given what's going on around them.
You mentioned Dean Price. He's from North Carolina, tobacco country. How does his story fit into the larger narrative that you're telling?
Well, I've never been anywhere that felt so old and so traditionally American as the Carolina Piedmont, which is the region that Dean comes from. It's tobacco country. There used to be textiles and furniture making. And then tobacco, as we know, fell with the 90s and the investigations and the tobacco buyout. And it kind of laid waste to what had been a very intact middle class and working class part of the country. Dean Price is a son of that region. His father was a Bible Belt preacher. His whole family had been tobacco farmers since the 18th century. They all lived within about 10 miles of each other in Rockingham County, North Carolina. And again, around the time of the financial crisis, Dean, who had this truck stop business, watched his business fail. So he turned to biofuels, and he has this whole vision, which I think is a very American vision of a resurgence, a kind of renaissance of the countryside through alternative energy. But he's doing it on his own. No one is telling him to. There's no organization he's part of. There's no union or business trade association or newspaper that he's connected. He's a loner out there. He's a Johnny Appleseed spreading biodiesel across the countryside.
But I could imagine some people would say, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what America's about. You articulate a dream, a goal, and you go do it, and sometimes you have to do it alone.
That's true. It's a very deep American dream. It's not the only American dream. There's also a dream of being part of a community, and it's the dissolution of these communities that's so painful to see. Because as Dean said to me while we were walking around Madison, North Carolina, the town that he grew up in, the shoe store was closed down, the pharmacy was shuttered, the restaurants were closed, there were just a couple people on the sidewalk. You see this in little towns all across the heartland. He said the guys who used to own those stores were the pillars of this community. They coached the Little League teams, they were on the town council. They're gone, and communities can't suffer that way without great consequences.
Is this just another part of a cycle, or is this unwinding as you see it different?
In some ways, it is cyclical. I think we've been through it many times before. So I don't want to say this is it. You know, we'll never come back from this. We've come back before. We've often come back stronger. What I see happening is not just cyclical, though. It feels like a real cultural shift where the value of the community, of what makes this a coherent society, has really been submerged. And it's not all dark. We've been talking as if it's a completely dismal picture. But what isn't dark is the energy and the vitality and the humor and the dreams, as well as the screw-ups and the setbacks of the characters in the book. When I stop thinking about the big picture and institutions and leaders, and I think about these people who I got to know so well, they still give me hope.
The book is called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George Packer joined us in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.